It is powerful, very powerful. We will need your help.
Okay, so Ogre Cave Audio Report, still doing it. I may even manage to talk to somebody who hasn't designed a story game at some point. But for now, we're talking with a designer that I think is one of the more interesting up-and-coming designers right now, Mr. Jonathan Walton.
Thank you, appreciate that.
He's with us. He's the editor of Push, the new thinking about role-playing journal, which is going to be an annual, is that correct?
Yes, we're hoping to have one ready for Gen Con next year.
All right. That's a good place to put it. That's
yeah. Well, it's just that it took 2 years to get the first issue out, and a lot of that was administrative work and just sort of the wrangling of cats that comes with trying to get a group of people who I really appreciate and respect a lot to get together and sit down and actually write something and work through it. But now that we've done it, it seems like it's going to be easier to work through the second issue, which is hopefully going to be even bigger and full of more diverse things.
Right on. What's the response been like?
It's been really good. The interesting thing about the it's a sort of a non-traditional product for Gen Con because it has a few short games in it, but one of the games is meant for it's based on classical Indian dance, so it's a little hard to demo at a little small booth. You know, we'd have to have a big room and tape on the floor to map out where the kind of the map of play and stuff. And the other one, the one that I wrote, Waiting Tea, is really made for online play. So we haven't been able to demo it, you know, really effectively, but a lot of people have been talking about it. Which is amazing.
I hadn't gathered that that was made for online play, but that makes total sense with your approach.
Sure, I mean, it definitely could be played face-to-face, and it works really well. And it probably lasts about, say, 25 minutes to a half hour, probably, when you play it face-to-face. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely written more for online play, yeah. So.
Yeah, this is to explain to the listeners. This is a game that's sort of inspired by interactive fiction and text adventures, where you have kind of a chain of events that are available to you, but then it adds kind of narration and reactions on top of it.
Like if you think about older role playing games for the computer, where you would have to type in a command line and grab this object and whatever. It's sort of based on that approach where you have a tree of options and you sort of move down through them, and doing some options opens up other options. And then there's also a level of what I call expressions in the game, which are basically things that don't have any sort of weight within the system, but they could be anything. It could be making a snowball, it could be hitting somebody in the face. And these things don't have any sort of mechanical weight, but they still are. But they affect the way other characters treat you. Because obviously, if you punch someone in the face, they're not going to be willing to do much for you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a play on what does and doesn't matter in a game.
I don't know. There was also, what I thought was great was somebody had first of all, I love the marginalia.
Yes.
The built-in peanut gallery in the margin.
Sure, it's sort of the director's commentary version, like you have on DVDs, yeah.
You know, all through it, and somebody in the margins to Waiting for the Queen Tea at Midnight was saying, I totally want to try this as a live game between me and my partner and redraw the map so it's our apartment.
Right, totally. So do a little sort of romance thing there, yeah.
Yeah. One of the key themes running through your games and your game writing I think they're very dramatic games. I feel like they're closer to theater than a lot of what other folks are doing. What do you think story games could learn from theater more generally, or even from LARPs?
Sure. I haven't done a whole lot of LARP stuff myself. I feel inspired by people who write about LARPs, but I don't have a lot of personal experience. I have some theater background, but not a lot. I think that what role-playing really could learn from theater in a lot of ways is that there's nothing to be feared necessarily from having sort of limits on character action. I think a lot of times in role-playing we like to think about limits on character ability. So you have skills and attributes that you have to roll against and that sort of thing. I think limits on character action are sort of what give characters structure. If you think about plays and that sort of stuff, normally in plays you have all your lines are scripted or whatever. Mm-hmm. Improvisational theater, a lot of times, they will have characters who have scripted personalities who can and can't do certain things. And I think that there's a sense in role-playing where there's more games coming out that have these sorts of limits, where you define a character not necessarily by what they're able to do, but what they will do. I'm defined by I would not do that. That's just not against my character. And sort of based along in a different way than you think traditional sort of alignments and those sorts of systems, where they're not, you know, you don't get bonuses or penalties from doing certain things. You just can't do it. There's some things that, like, this is the line my character would not cross. Mm-hmm. And so you get a sense of character that's based more on, well, like I said, more on, you know, what you will do instead of what you can do.
All right, so my big question...
Sure, go for it.
...for everyone has been, where do you see story games go, or where do you want to see story games in 5 to 10 years?
Wow. Well, I think, in general, story games are... There's a lot of interesting stuff going on right now, first of all. I think this year especially you can see sort of persisting interests in the kinds of trust mechanics that Tim Kleinert first worked out in The Mountain Witch. Mm-hmm. They're showing up in games like Cold City, where you have people really interested in sort of inter-character issues of relationships. It seems to be a big issue. I think that's going to continue to be hot for the next 5 years. People are going to be really interested in relationship maps or and that sort of thing. I think you'll continue to see... at least in the indie scene, people moving away from traditional game master player divides, where you'll have more and more narrative power in the hands of the players, and also GMs becoming sort of different kinds of, not necessarily the person who's in charge of all the narrative structure and all the plotting, but you'll see them take on different roles, sort of unusual roles, where they're asked to do things that traditional GMs didn't do. So I think you'll definitely see people playing around with those sort of relationships. I think... Also, you'll see more games that that basically seem to not be role-playing games at all in a traditional sense. You'll see games that don't have skills, that don't have attributes, that don't have a combat system, that don't have character sheets, that don't have... and you'll look at it and you'll say, isn't this really a board game or just a dice game or some sort of like...
Yeah.
Thomas Robertson accused one of my recent games of basically just being a pacing mechanic. That there's no, that's all it is. It's just where how to structure something so that when you say it, when the narrative comes out, it is paced in such a way that it feels like a good story. That it's not about, you know, conflict or whatever else. It's just pacing. So I think you'll see more games that are surprising in that way, where... that come from a background of role-playing, that feel like games when you play them, because that's kind of the genre in which they're written, but really are doing something that's very different.
Hmm. It may be the same game that we're talking about. It's Kasakame Kyoto Kills.
Oh, that's one of them, yeah.
Kills Kublai Khan,
It's a game that I've written recently. It wasn't the specific one that Thomas was talking about.
Okay.
But that's definitely an example.
Yeah, that game is, I want to call that up because it's,
sure.
That game is almost all ritual.
Yes.
I mean, you had things like the ritual phrases in Polaris that kind of are used to make your game moves. But that game is almost just strictly, you know, I say this, you say that, and you introduce story material within that.
Sure.
And it's...
I was working on a series of two-player games because I was trying to figure out, you know, how these inter-player interactions work and how you could structure not just, you know, what a character will do, but how a character will do it. In case of Kasakami Kyoko Kills Kublai Khan or KKKKK, or however you want to call it, it's just about...
K5.
K5, yeah. There's two characters, and both of what they have to say is very scripted because it's a very ritualized thing. Kublai Khan has a very structured way in which he must say phrases, and so does Kasakami Kyoko, who has come to kill him. And they trade things back and forth. It's like a tennis match. You know, it's very structured. Like in tennis, you can't, you know, just do whatever you want to. You have to hit the ball over the net back to the other side, and that's what happens here. But it's fun because you don't necessarily know how the person on the other side is going to return the ball, you know, if you think of it as a tennis match. And so while it's a very structured experience, the fun comes in the unexpected parts. And if what you can do is more structured, you find more creativity in the openness, in the parts that aren't structured. I think this is what's really powerful for me.
Creative constraints.
Sure.
Yeah.
This came up a lot in Push, actually, a lot. And whenever it came up, Paul Tevis was just like, yes, more constraint. I love it. constraint. People, I think, in general in role-playing, traditionally have feared sort of a lot of constraint on the player because they feel like, oh, this is limiting my fun, like I can't make these choices, this isn't fun for me, or whatever, it's going to make me do stuff that I don't want to do. Where I think if you embrace constraint in the sense of a limiting of your choices, when you have a few choices, you're able to find, I guess, beautiful, creative, wonderful things in that sort of small space that you wouldn't have thought of before. Because when you have, you know, you have this whole expanse of choices in front of you, it's hard to know what to choose. People complain about this with games where you have, 300 pages of setting, you know, and there's so many choices, you know, where do you begin? And there's, and I think people are beginning to see that, you know, small focused things where you have, you go from this step to that step and sort of you have a progression, it really gives people freedom in a way that is sort of non-intuitive. Mm-hmm. So you think more constraint, you know, less choices, but no, more constraint, more specific choices, but in some ways more interesting choices.
Yeah, yeah. I think ritual is going to, you know, as we get to understand it better as part of game design,
sure,
is going to even produce, as it's going to be as big a factor in producing sure. creativity. Because, I mean, ritual gets to the essence of what a game is.
Sure.
You know, there's a game just kind of is, you're stepping inside the magic circle,
sure.
and you know, it's...
And I think this is going to become even more the case when I really hope this happens, where people move away from role-playing as something that's necessarily involved with a commercial product.
Yeah.
Which is, this is a really revolutionary idea. Okay, look, what if I wrote a game and wasn't actually interested in selling you anything, wasn't actually interested in giving you a, you know, whatever, I'm not making a living off this, you know, I'm probably never going to make a living off this, I don't really want to make a living off this necessarily, but the idea that play is the most important part. And so if play is just in some ways ritualized experience, where you're in here to create an experience, to create memories that will be memorable, that you can tell your friends about and be like, man, that was awesome. If you're creating experiences instead of creating products, role-playing becomes something unbelievable, something that we probably can't even imagine at this point.
Well, a lot of the role-playing community has taken that position for a while. It's
sure.
like, you know, but it's mainly been the people who, you know, the free-formers who are like, you know, we're beyond
sure.
rules.
Sure.
You know, of course, they're not beyond rules. They
sure.
have implicit rules.
Sure.
But having an actual sort of oral tradition of explicit rules
sure.
and having people think of that as something that's decommercialized.
Sure. Or not
that
even
can be very powerful.
The thing is, the oral tradition is not even what we're limited by now, because you think with the internet and the ability to freely distribute things.
Yeah. Well, the internet kind of is an oral tradition in its way.
Sure. I mean, a different kind of tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. But yeah, it's a new way to disseminate information in a way that wasn't possible before. So if you were going to, you know, freely disseminate something, you'd have to print it out yourself and have a huge cost and it's just not feasible. But I think the internet is going to do things for like I said, non-commercial role playing, which is going to be really exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
On the subject, okay, last question.
Sure, sure.
On the subject of opening the community up.
Yes.
One of the biggest complaints about kind of the story games community right
sure,
now
sure.
is that. It's a lot of it's going on online, and a lot of those online communities are either closed, literally,
right.
or they're kind of forbidding to newcomers.
Right, sure.
I mean, what would you do to help open things up if you could wave a magic wand and do anything?
Wave a magic wand and do anything. Well, actually, Jess Hammer and I have been talking recently about trying to get different bodies of role players together, because we know that there's this huge body of you know, online freeform, interactive
yeah.
fiction writing, you know, the Nordic LARP community, the Japanese role-playing community, which is way different from the United States. There's people role-playing in ways that are really interesting and fascinating, but are not necessarily really well connected. Like, I feel like there are people doing it who aren't really communicating directly with each other. And it would be really great to wave a magic wand and have all of us just sit down at a table and be like, this is what I'm doing, isn't it great? And have this sharing. Because I definitely think there's things that we can learn from each other. Because, I mean, it's essentially it's the same medium in different formats. Because you see people in different situations doing it in different ways. So I think... you know, that's the magic wand solution. I think what we could do in real life, you know, more proactively, is spend more time listening to each other. And I think this is something that I think traditionally as a community we're very bad at. I think the indie community tends to listen more to people in the indie community. I think the mainstream role-playing community tends to listen to mainstream role-playing fans and other designers. And I think the online interactive freeform people tend to listen more to people from their community. And so part of what we need to do is become members of those communities ourselves. Open yourself up. You know, I mean, I'm a fan of mainstream role-playing as well as a fan of indie role-playing. But I feel like I'm not as engaged with people who are actually doing work in the industry and doing that sort of stuff. And also I feel like, I mean, I came to The Forge, which is a really interesting thing. Before I came to The Forge, I was involved with a lot of online interactive fiction writing. And I feel like I've broken away from that. I've become part of this community and lost sort of where I came from in that
about
sense.
By interactive fiction writing, are you talking about IF or are you talking about online
No,
freeform?
No, this is like online freeform.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry, it's confusing. So many different words for the same thing. It's fascinating. But yeah, I was... yeah, definitely doing like play by email games. And my first post on the Forge was like, I want to design for play by email, right? And I still don't think there's a game. Well, aside from maybe Deep Profundus or something like that. But there's a whole, and also the internet is, besides being a way of disseminating information, it's a new place to play. And you see more and more play happening there. But it's in some ways play that us in the mainstream and indie role playing communities are totally blind to in a lot of ways. There's stuff going on there that, and it's because it's an oral tradition and because there's not formalized rule books and because there's not, we're used to looking at products. You know, this is what I'm talking about, the commercialization in some ways. Like even in the indie community, this is a product and that's a product. But when you look at a community, they have ways of playing that aren't written down. And this has been historically true in role playing as well. You know, this is how we get, role playing systems. It's just people sitting at home with their friends and doing things. So I think if we can, you know, learn from people who don't have a product to sell, who don't need a book in order to, learn about what they're doing, because in a lot of cases what people are doing is not based on books at all. I mean, this is even true in mainstream role-playing communities, and people may be playing D&D in a completely radical awesome way that we need to know about. But because we all consider it all D&D and it's all sort of the same, like nobody's going down there and recording it and figuring out what's going on.
And sometimes they're not thinking they record it, or they might not even really be thinking about the fact that they're doing it that differently.
And they might even not even know that they're doing it differently. It may be something that just seems normal to them. So
The people here at Gen Con, the whole NASCRAG tournament, are you familiar with this?
No.
This is like, it's a big dungeon crawl tournament, but it's like rather on the silly side. A lot of it is, you know, puzzle solving and such, rather than using the rules. And when the combat does happen, you know, in a given run through, there's usually at least one combat.
Sure.
When it does happen, it's rules light enough that it was described to me as being like, well, you know, you basically have to remember how to roll for initiative, and then the DM will probably take care of the rest.
Sure.
And it's like, why are those guys calling what they do D&D?
Right.
What they're doing is fun on its own. D&D doesn't deserve to absorb all the credit for that.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's. I mean, if you think about, you know, there's been this, I guess, historical trend in role playing to have a role playing text that you're using as your basis, whether it's D&D or whatever you're playing, and basically take out all the stuff that you don't like, emphasize the stuff that you do like, and sort of continually work it with your group. I mean, people are making adjustments constantly, and so you really wonder whether whether you can really call play of any game really is it really related to that game, or is it really more individual by groups? You know, is it really a bunch of different things that are happening instead of one thing.
Right on. We could find stuff to talk about for a long ass time, but I think my battery's about to run out.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, Jonathan Walton, thank you
very much.
All right, and that is that.
Sweet.